Okay, welcome everyone to Great Gifts of the Jews, Part 4. We are sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ila Nishmat Yona Ben Harav Aryeh Leib, Olav HaShalom. And the Great Gifts of the Jews, we look at how the Jewish people shape the world. And tonight we'll discuss societal institutions. So we've already discussed an overview of the gifts of the Jews to the world, what we taught the world about God, what we taught the world about man. And tonight we'll discuss societal institutions that we created through the Torah, of course, or shaped or refined. Each one, in its own way, revolutionized mankind. Take one, for example. We'll look at really three tonight. Marriage. To understand the uniqueness of marriage, we have to first explore another revolution that we wrought in the world, and that is the status of women. It's ironic because many feminists give the Torah and the Torah observant community no rest, complaining about inequality, about the assignment of differing roles, about the patriarchy with varying levels of sincerity. It's ironic because the Torah elevated and safeguarded the status of women from creation in a way that took a very long time for the world to catch up. In ancient times, because of women's physical inferiority, they could not produce materially the same way a man did. They weren't field workers or farmers, didn't have the same abilities. So women were maintained, often in one home in multiple numbers, to give birth to children and to rear them and take care of the home and really produce more workers for an agrarian society, or produce more girls, women who could give birth to more workers. They played no role in public affairs. Women had few no economic or civil rights, and only in pagan societies, did they have a place in spiritual matters. There, and even there, almost always in some sort of sexual capacity. The Torah decreed a new understanding, complete spiritual and substantive equality. Vayivra Elokim et Adam et Salmo. God created man in his image, but Salam Elokim bara oto. In the image of God, he was created. He, singular, Zachar nekeva bara otam. Male and female, he created them, meaning, in terms of Salam Elokim, the spiritual worth of man and woman was the same. The Torah does not distinguish between males and females regarding their inherent worth. Both were created, B'Tselem Elokim. And this is reiterated in Perek Hay of Breshid. Ze Sefer Toldot Adam. This is the book of the genealogy of man. B'Yom Baro Elokim Adam B'Dmut Elokim Asoto. The day God created man, he created him in his image. Zachar Nekev Abram. Male and female, they were created. V'Varech Otam. God blessed them. Vayikrat Shemam Adam, he called their name Adam, Biyom Hibaram, on the day they were created. Meaning they were created the same day, but it's even more than that. To underscore the point, Chazal say that Adam was created a dual creature, male and female, back to back, and then separated. Shnei partsufim hayalo le'adam achor v'kedem. Man had two faces, one in back, and that was the separation that entailed the creation of Chava. Moreover, the original blessing that given to Adam pertained to both male and female. Vayivarech otam Elokim. God blessed them. Vayomer lohem Elokim. God said to them, peru urvu. As such, there's a natural bond that was created between man and woman, and there's an avowed deficiency in the man who's unmarried. Gemara says, "Amar Rabbi Elazar, kol adam she'ein lo isha, eino adam. Any man that does not have a wife is not even a man. She'nemar zachar u'nekeva bra'am. The man's very masculinity is under assault." And all this aside from the spiritual and practical benefits to marriage. As the Gemara notes and the Ramah emphasizes at the beginning of Evan Ezer, V'chol mi she'ein lo isha shori b'lo bracha. Whoever lacks a wife exist without blessing, below Torah, without Torah, continue the Gemara, v'lo nikra adam, he's not even called a man. V'cheven shenasa isha, avonotav mikpakpakim. When a man marries, his sins begin to fade and disappear. Shenemar, matza isha matza tov, v'yofek ratzon meit Hashem. One who finds a woman has found good, and he fulfills God's will. He derives good vibes from the fact that he's married. He assists and furthers the purpose of creation. So it's true that the Mechaber began Evan Ezer with a focus on marriage for procreation. A man has to marry in order to procreate. But that's because that is the mitzvah. And the Shulchan Aruch is a halachic work. You see, the Ramah did not begin that way. Because marriage has an innate value even beyond procreation as the completion of a human being, a return to the intimate state when male and female were two parts of a whole. So this accentuates, today's marriage crisis. There are fewer Americans married today, American adults, than ever before, who are unmarried. Marriage is considered archaic and unnecessary. So how quaint are the words of the Ibn Ezra on Zachar Unikeva Braham, Bavur Shaloi Tochein Shivalele Echad Mehem Nifrad. It's unthinkable that one can procreate without the other. All right? I guess it's very controversial today. Modern life is putting that very plausible maxim to the test and paying a steep price for it. Where marriage has declined, obviously birth rates are in decline, happiness is in decline, and we see throughout the West where the birth rate is below replacement rates, with all that means for societal dysfunction. So on the first day of man's existence, Adam was given a mate. Lo tov hayot Adam levado, ayaselo ezer kinegdo. God says it's not good for man to be alone, I'll give him a helpmate, a partner, a psychological match, and thus the family unit was born with a different perspective than the one to which the ancient world understood. That Kedat Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Aramaz, one of the Golei Sfarad, one of those Jews expelled from Spain, explicitly rejected the idea that marriage is based al yachas hamini luvad, just on a sexual relationship, kishar balechayim, as it is, meaning that type of intimacy, cohabitation, exists in the animal kingdom. Rather, he says, the purpose of marriage, sheyu lochem yachas ishi miyuchad, that man should have a special personal relationship with his wife, and that strengthens their love so that they help each other in everything. Ezer gamur v'shalem kasher yod lahem. And it's a complete and full partner, helpmeet, as it pleases them. Each couple seeing life and creating their marriage or the various division of needs and responsibilities as they see fit. And that is esolo ha'ezer v'hana'ot lo hashavelo. If one finds a helpmeet that's appropriate for him, that's worthy, that's a shavelo, that's his equivalent. And that point is also emphasized, the essential equality. The Sforna writes on that pasuk, Ezer Kenegdo, Ezer sheye kemo shavelo b'tzelem udmud, equal to man in form and image. So the differences in the treatment of men and women, according to the Torah, contrary to popular understanding, are actually minute. Gemara says in Kiddush Daf Lamed Hey Amud Aleph, Hishva Kotov Isha LeIsh V'Chol Dinim SheBetorah. The Torah compares, equates men and women for all the halachot in the Torah. Hishva Kotov Ish LeIsha L'Chol Anashim SheBetorah. Man, the Torah equates man and woman for all the punishments in the Torah. So there, we obsess on the exceptions that are so few compared to Tarek Mitzvah, and there are exceptions. Whether Mitzvah Taseh Shazman Grama, a time-bound positive commandments, or in the methodology of divorce or marriage or inheritance. So those are really exceptions, and those are all designed to protect women, even if, as inevitable, it doesn't work out perfectly in every single case. You know, the Rambam writes in the Moreh. Please mute. The Rambam writes in the Moreh that no legal system can ensure that there's perfect justice in every single case. And sometimes it's the dearth of our intellect that prevent us from seeing the equity in every single... Okay, I'll take the pause to thank again... I'm relying in part on the work I've been quoting extensively from, The Innovations of Tanakh by Professor Amnon Shapira of Bar-Ilan University. Retired, of course, but a very, really comprehensive work. Not all, but a lot. But nonetheless, thus it was the Torah that afforded women civil rights, property rights, economic protections, personal rights, all of which were unheard of in the ancient world. But the drive for absolute equality, which is the religion of egalitarianism, has not really helped women and has not helped society. Only a divine system can account in a legal system for the disparate treatments, again, as minute as they are, of men and women because of the psychological differences or because of the practical expectations of each. What perplexes and vexes many feminists is that the Torah does not perceive absolute equality as a value and even as an ideal, and that's true. In the West, especially in the modern world, that's a primary value. So it's an open question whether such an approach has helped or hurt women, and we should not expect the Torah to adopt an inferior system, or one ill-suited to human nature, or one premised on human values. The greatness of Torah is that it represents eternal and divine values. Nevertheless, it's critical to note that we brought to the world the idea that men and women have equal spiritual worth. Both, as Rav Soloveitchik wrote, stood at Sinai. Both are indispensable parts of the covenantal community. Both have identical worth as human beings. Both a part of the extraordinary historical destiny of the Jewish people. Both can commune with God. And both accepted the Torah at Sinai, where the acceptance would have been incomplete. Nasa v'nishma was not a declaration of the males. It was a declaration of everyone. And this was a novel idea. Certainly within our system, there's flexibility also. Under Torah law, for example, a husband is obligated to support his wife. A wife is not obligated to support her husband. Don't share that notion in various parts of the religious community. But the couple can make any relationship or any arrangement they want based on mutual consent, any financial arrangement. And this is true in many areas. The advances in women's status have far more to do with social conditions than with halacha. And we should be clear, what is halacha. But what was not done, not because it was asur, but just because it was not done, so that always carries less weight. It carries some weight, but less weight, and in those realms, you'll find many of the changes in modern life. I mentioned the past. I laugh at the assertion that women's education, Torah education, was original 100 years ago, meaning a formal education, because men's education was quite innovative 100 years ago. In Europe for centuries, aside from the cheder, there was little formal education for boys. The elite, a relative handful, learned into and passed adolescence. But let's go back in our history. It was during the reign of Chizkiyahu, as the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Daf Tzadi Dalet Amud Bet, Bad Kumi Don Bad Bersheva, Vlo Matzu Amaretz. They checked from the north to the south, didn't find the Jewish ignoramus, Migvat Vad Antipatris, Vlo Matzu Tinok Vitinoket, Ishvi Isha. They searched, scoured the whole country. They did not find a boy or a girl, a man or a woman who were not proficient in the laws of Tumah and Tahara, ritual purity and impurity. So there's a sort of universal education for all Jews to know the basics of Jewish life, and this was also unique. And it was formalized a few centuries later. As the Gemara Baba Batra, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph, Baram Zichor Oto Ish L'Tov V'Yoshua Ben Gamla Shmo. We remember this historic individual for good, named Yoshua Ben Gamla. Shel Malei Hu Nishtach Achtor Mi'Yisrael. But for him, the Torah would have been forgotten from the Jewish people. Shebitchil, at first, Misha Yesh Lo Av Milamdo Torah. Whoever had a father, the father taught him Torah. Whoever didn't have a father, there was no teacher, he didn't learn. Ad Shabagmar continues, but ends. Ad Shabay Yeshua ben Gamla v'tikein, Yeshua ben Gamla ordained. Sheyu Moshivim elamdei tinoko pechol medino medino v'chol yir v'ir. U'machnis natan kaven sheish kaven shava. He established a system of formal education, melamdei tinokot, in every province, in every city, and children begin to study from the age of 6 or the age of 7. Yeah, the girls weren't always involved in that, and that study was primarily for boys who had a chiyuv, an obligation of Talmud Torah, but nonetheless, there was a system where all Jews were learned, and they all knew exactly what they had to know. But this is a sidebar. Not everything in the last century is unprecedented, but it's more often more sociological than it is halachic, and sometimes the distinction can only be ascertained by the Gedolei Hador, who are the Bali Mesorah. But in any event, Adam was given a mate, and marriage was born. And even though their relationship was unique, we still learn from it, as it features in several of the Sheva Brachot. We mention Adam and Chava, just like God set them up, so too we believe God still makes matches. We see our spouses like they're the only ones in the world for us, just like Adam and Chava were, literally the only ones in the world for each other. And despite some slips and falls, and they had the trouble with the children also, so they made it work. So how do we view marriage then? What was the revolutionary idea we brought to the world? And remember, Christians, going back to the early church, thought marriage was a concession, not an ideal, that the ideal is to be celibate and unmarried. We hold it's not only a mitzvah to marry, it's a mitzvah to help other people marry and to set them up and to provide for their wedding. And as noted, the man is obligated to support his wife, in exchange for which he receives use of certain of her property. Some he returns intact or restores the value of the original principal, we call nichsei tzom barzel, the assets that are like iron sheep, and for which he's fully liable, and somebody only benefits from the fruit, or the rental income, nichsei malog, but which remain in her ownership, and so he is not liable. So in exchange, the husband supports her, is entitled to her income, her work product, whatever she finds, her housework, cooking, etc. But she has the right to say, the Gemara says in Ketubah, Daf Nun Chet Amud Bet, Yechola Isha Lomar Lebalo, Eini Nizonet V'Eini Osa. She could say to her husband, don't support me, and I won't work for you, I'll keep what I earn. She has the right to say that. And that affords flexibility to the couple while protecting the majority of women who are not in that situation. So needless to say, all this was transformative. And it's why the Jewish family has been the envy of mankind since the beginning of our national existence. And that Bilam saw, Matovu Ohalecho Yaakov. And Rav Kook wrote, it's in Ma'amea Re'iyah, in the first Chelek, page 192, Hamishpacha Shalanu Hilanu Kedusha Bitsura Harbe Yoter Amuka Mimashihi Bechol HaOlam. Our family unit is sacred in a way that is more profound than you'll find in the rest of the modern world. And I dare say that that's why the Jewish family is still the envy of mankind, and people want that. I've met in my life gerim, converts, who began the process of conversion because they wanted to have a family like the Jewish family, imbued with that sense of purpose and holiness and commitment. That's what they wanted. That is something we should nurture. Ah, you might ask, if you weren't muted, what about polygamy that you find in the Torah as well? So Professor Shapira quotes Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who makes a profound and sweeping point. And he says, like other cases, slavery, for example, the Torah distinguishes between the ideal and the reality. Reality, Rabinovich wrote, does not always conform to our most exalted yearnings. Certainly war teaches us that as well. So in truth, there was not much polygamy already in the time of the Talmud, which referred to so-called sister wives as tsarot, meaning adversaries, or people who just caused tsarot for each other. It did not generally make for a happier or more efficient home. Not that it doesn't have its uses. And Professor Shapira continued that eventually the ideal caught up with the reality, and polygamy was banned by Rabbeinu Gershom more than a millennium ago. So I'm not as sanguine as that. Polygamy is certainly problematic. Wouldn't work for everybody. It hasn't stopped modern men from seeking variety and betraying his deepest values and ruining his marriage. So who knows what will happen in the future. But no doubt our conception of marriage indelibly shaped the world's view of marriage. And additionally, it's worthy of its own analysis, but suffice it to say that marriage creates families. And the family unit, our family unit, is not perceived, as has been true in ancient times and very, very modern times, like in fascist or communist societies, even socialist societies. The family unit is perceived not as a tool of the state or a servant of the state, but as a private enterprise that, combined with other such private enterprises, builds the community and the nation. That's the first institution. The second we can discuss is Shabbat as the day of rest. So it's uncanny that the world adopted a seven-day week, exactly as the Torah ordained. I remember reading years ago that ancient China experimented with a 10-day week, 3 weeks in a month. It didn't take. But strangely enough, in more recent times, the French did the same thing. The French instituted a 10-day week, 3 weeks in a month, after the French Revolution, but that too was abolished by Napoleon. So the seven-day week became fixed throughout the history of mankind. And with the seven-day week in the Torah came the notion of the day of rest, which we find already at the end of the first parak, beginning of the second parak of Bereishit, a day on which people stopped being worker bees, stopped serving a human master, a day in which the productive, constructive, and the physical creative world came to a temporary halt. And not only for Jews, even for their servants, even for their cattle. The Aseret Dibrot in Vatchanan and Dvarim, the Yom HaShviyi Shabbat Hashem Elokecha, the seventh day is the Shabbat to God. Lo tase kol melacha ata uvincha uvitecha, should do no constructive labor, neither you, your son, your daughter, avdecha v'amotecha, your male servant, your female servant, v'shorcha v'chamercha, your ox, your donkey, v'chol behemtecha, all your cattle, v'gercha shebesherecha, even the stranger in your midst, l'man yanuach avdecha v'amotecha kamocha, so your servant should rest exactly like you do. V'zacharta ki eved hayita be'eretz Mitzrayim. And through the Shabbat, you'll remember that you were servants in the land of Egypt. Ve'yotzeacha Hashem Elokecha misham biyad chazaka uvizra netiyah. God took you out from there with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Al kein tzivcha Hashem Elokecha lasot et yom haShabbat. Therefore, God commanded you to observe, to make the Shabbat day. So Shabbat is not only a day of renewal, it is a day on which the equality of all is pronounced. The king and the servant, the executive and the day laborer, all desist from their daily activities to acknowledge a greater reality, capital R, and man's place vis-a-vis the Creator, and not just one of His creations. It's in the Dibrot and Shemot, There we find that man is called upon to be like the Creator. That's why we remember that God created the world in 6 days, rested on the seventh. Be like God, a Creator, but in the spiritual realm. And to contemplate on that day why we are here, and just not what we want to do while we are here. So obviously this was not an easy sell to the ruling class, which granted no Shabbat to the masses. It's interesting that Moshe convinced Paro to allow the Jews to rest on Shabbat because it would be better for him, for Paro. It's the Medrash Rabbah in the first parsha in Shmot. Vayar b'sivlota, Moshe went out, as a young man, saw the suffering of the people. Rasha ein lahem menucha. He saw that they had no rest. They're working 7 days a week. Halach v'amar l'paro, he went and said to Paro, Misha yeshlo eved, im eino nach yom echa b'shavu hu meit. Whoever has a servant, he doesn't rest 1 day a week, he's going to die. Ve'el avadecha, these are your servants. You don't let them be, let them rest 1 day a week, they're going to die. So Paro said to Moshe, Lech vaselem, Moshe tomar, go and tell them to do what you want them to do. Halach Moshe v'tikein lehem et yom ha-shabbat lenuach. Moshe went and ordained this Shabbat, and of course the people were reintroduced to Shabbat at Mara, weeks before the revelation at Sinai, where Shabbat is one of the 10 utterances. Who else struggled with this concept besides Paro? Well, every tyrant does, but Haman struggled with it, as recorded by Rav Moshe Alshich in his commentary on Tehillim. Tachat avati yistanuni, in place of my love, they hated me, they despised me, something we're familiar with in our world. That is what Haman said. Haman said to Ahasuerus, Hinei ha'om hazeh me'amdim mimonam b'shahi pahi. The people are squandering your money because they're always saying shahi pahi, they can't work. What does it mean? Shahi pahi? Shabbat hayom, Pesach hayom. They're always finding a reason why they can't work. Today's Shabbat, today's Pesach, it's an early Friday, it's a 2 day Yom Tov, whatever it is. Amad Michal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, the angel Michal, stood before Hashem and said, "Klum banecha mit katrigin al shabru taratecha, eino ela al shekimu madech bavatamotcha." He said, "Your children are being prosecuted because they keep your Shabbat, they keep your Torah, they keep your festivals." Omar Kadosh Baruch Hu, Chayecha, Lo Shavket Vlo Eshbog. God said, they keep Shabbat, I will not abandon them, I will never leave them alone to others. You see, people, especially in power, always have a problem with this. And the idea that we have now of a 7 day work week, some businesses never stop, it should be troubling. A day of rest became universal in the world, and it became universal despite the opposition, through us. In 321, the Roman Emperor Constantine decreed, he said, on the venerable day of the sun, known to us as Sunday, let the magistrates and people residing in cities rest, and let all workshops be closed. That was Constantine. And this became traditional throughout the empire, Roman Empire and beyond. It is indispensable to people who perceive their lives as transcending their worker bee status. It confounds those who don't have any other life, and thus it is a struggle for them, and why so many Jews who are not yet part of the world of Shomrei Shabbat think, how could I have a Shabbat without the electronics and the phone and the iPhone, the iPad, and all that? For centuries, though, this day, whichever it was, Shabbat, Sunday, became a day of church-going, of reflection, of family, of big dinners. We have the Shabbat dinner. Others had their Sunday dinner. Until the 1960s, blue laws prohibited commercial establishments from opening on Sundays. And these laws, which were religious in origin, and instituted first by the Puritans, but then broadly adopted, were deemed, strange as it sounds, constitutional by the United States Supreme Court, which saw in them a secular purpose in providing a day of rest. Just go back over a century and a quarter ago. A case of Hennington versus Georgia, 1896, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that Georgia, which laws had barred railroad trains from running on Sundays, they're allowed to do it. It's within their powers, notwithstanding its effect on interstate commerce, meaning a train coming from South Carolina could not enter Georgia on Sunday or from Florida north. Because there's a purpose in having a day of rest when there's no commercial activity going on. In 1961, in McGowan versus Maryland, the court ruled 8-1, 63 years ago. Only Justice Douglas dissented. Maryland could force stores to close on Sundays. And even though it was religious in origin, there's a state interest in having a uniform day of rest. And the court said plaintiffs here have no standing because only their economic interests are affected. Nothing religious is being imposed on them. They're just being told they can't work. So people were routinely arrested in 18th and 19th century America for violating the Sabbath. Talk about fiat datit. And this directly harmfully affected Jews, who now had to close 2 days a week, Shabbat and Sunday. So, for example, in the 1850s, a Jewish merchant in California was sentenced to 35 days in prison for selling on Sunday. He was closed on Shabbat. But a state judge in California, ruled the law unconstitutional. Nevertheless, in the 1950s, a Massachusetts court ruled in favor of Crown Kosher Supermarket in Massachusetts, holding that Henning was obsolete and that blue laws were unconstitutional. But that was a state decision, not the U.S. Supreme Court decision. As a new justice, Potter Stewart, noted in dissent in one of the 1961 cases, Pennsylvania has passed a law which compels an Orthodox Jew to choose between his religious faith and his economic survival. That's a cruel choice, which I think no state can constitutionally demand. For me, this is not something that can be swept under the rug and forgotten in the interest of enforced Sunday togetherness. I think the impact of this law upon these appellants grossly violates their constitutional right to the free exercise of their religion. This is Braunfels versus Brown, 1961. But he was in dissent. They lost. The court upheld the constitutionality of the blue laws. Well, as in many cases, probably as it should be, the people have the last word. And as the United States secularized, almost all of the blue laws were repealed, except, curiously, in Bergen County, New Jersey, where I lived for many years, 26 years, where the three big malls and most stores remain closed on Sundays, mainly because the residents fear the traffic congestion. So the county residents voted about 10 years ago to keep the blue laws. So they just voted not to put it on the ballot. And I remember one congregant related to me, he's voting in favor of the blue laws. He said, this way, the most my wife can shop is 4.5 days a week instead of 5.5 days. It's a cost-cutting measure. Now, of course, undermined by Amazon. In a secular world, Sunday has become a big leisure day, like Shabbat here, unfortunately, for the secular. And people struggle mightily to fill the day. Baseball and football and gardening and washing the car, family visits. So all these reflect the institution of Shabbat, even if not its ultimate purpose. But it's hard to imagine. It is hard to imagine. Sunday baseball, professional baseball, was only permitted in New York in 1919. Only permitted in Massachusetts in 1929. And only permitted in Pennsylvania in 1934. That's 8 teams. That's half of Major League Baseball. Until then, teams just did not play on Sunday in those places, or they had to take a road trip, like the Pennsylvania teams would go and play in Chicago and Cincinnati on Sundays. The Philly teams would go to New York on Sundays. It's strange. Not only that, from 1929 to 1932, the Red Sox had to play their Sunday games at Braves Field. Remember, the Boston had two teams then, because Fenway Park was located less than 1,000 feet from a church, and the law still banned playing baseball 1,000 feet from a church. It's a different world. One remnant of the Blue Laws is the Sunday limitation on alcohol sales that's still extant in many places for fear that people have nothing to do except drink liquor will come to no good, especially at home. So whatever its fate, you know, all we can do is introduce to the world these good ideas. What they do with it, what they have done with it, that's their choice. Unfortunately, their choices do affect our choices as well. And Jews have gone in less than two centuries from majority Shomer Shabbat people to a majority Mechalel Shabbat people, although in Israel it's really changing also. Nevertheless, in the recent history, that is a sea change with devastating consequences. It's not for nothing that Asher Ginzburg, Achad HaAm, the religious turned secular, so-called secular thinker, wrote in the late 19th century, more than the Jews have kept Shabbat, Shabbat has kept the Jews. It has made us a cohesive thinking, spiritual, reflective people. And as God said to Moshe, the Gemara quotes this in Shabbat Daf Yud Amud Bet, Matana Tova Yesh Li Bevegin Azai V'Shabbat Shema. I have this wonderful gift in my treasure house. It's called Shabbat. Ani Mevakesh Litnel Yisrael Lech Vodeyem. I want to give it to the Jewish people. Go tell them. It's a gift to us. It's a foundation of the covenant between God and the Jewish people. It's a brit, oti beini v'bein Yisrael. It's a sign of the covenant, but it's also one of our most magnificent gifts to the world. And third, you know, there are many other societal institutions, but let's just focus on three for tonight. The third that I thought about after marriage and Shabbat is one that is not often thought about enough, and that is democracy. This is somewhat controversial because we customarily look to ancient Greece for the roots of democracy, which literally rule of the people. So granted, the term is much mangled today. There's no pure democracy, certainly not in Israel, but even in America, it's really it's wielded today as a political weapon against one's opponent. You don't like what I say, you're against democracy. I don't like what you say, you're against democracy. Here too, it's the same thing. But America was founded as a republic, not as a democracy, a republic being a form of government in which people do not rule directly, but elect representatives who then rule. So in theory, the representatives are not simply the voices of the people. They don't take a poll to see what the people want them to do or vote, but they're supposed to use their own judgment in theory. In practice, where representatives stop representing the people's view, they generally become ex-representatives. So in theory, again, all three forms of government can be accommodated by the Torah. As the Beit HaLevi, where Yosef Ber Soloveitchik famously commented on the pasuk at the end of the Torah, V'zot HaBracha, V'hi Ben Shuren Melech, B'taseif Rashei Am, Yachad Shiftei Yisrael. He said, you find all forms of government there. V'hi Ben Shuren Melech, that's monarchy. B'taseif Rashei Am, where the leaders of the people, the heads of the people gather, that's representative Republican government. Yachad Shiftei Yisrael, all the tribes together, that would be democracy. So of course the Torah prefers a monarchy. Even that is disputed somewhat, as in the discussion of whether appointing a king is a mitzvah or a distasteful concession. But no doubt a monarchy in its most benevolent form is the most efficient and durable form of government. The problem is, of course, that not every king, not of Israel, not of anywhere, is always benevolent and wise. So the Greeks aside, in its inchoate form, the roots of democracy are in the Tanakh and in Jewish life in some fundamental ways. The world largely ignores this, awarding all credit to the Greeks. But who did know this? The founding fathers of the United States. They did know this, because they were steeped in the Bible and they knew exactly the type of polity that Jews tried to establish. So clearly the ideal form of government The ideal Jewish form of government is not democracy, rule of the people, but nonetheless, vital elements of democracy, as we understand it, are based on Torah concepts. For example, we were the first polity to have real separation of powers and an independent judiciary, not to mention a quite independent group of Nevi'im as well. So Sanhedrin was merit-based and served not only as a religious court and quasi-legislature, but also as a check on the king. So for example, the Rambam writes in the first parak of Hilchos Melachim, the Sanhedrin had to ratify the succession of a king, which was based on heredity. Ein mamid melech betchila el al pi beitim shivim zkeinim v'al pi navi. You would not designate a king at first, except based on the decision of the Sanhedrin of 70 and through a navi. Like Yeshua, appointed by Moshe and his beitim, Shaul and David, Shmuel and his beitim. Perek hey, halacha bet, only the Sanhedrin could declare an optional war, which was fought for territory or other mundane considerations. Milchemet mitzvah, ein otzarach litol bar reshut beitim. An obligatory war, you don't have to ask the reshut of the basin because the king is obligated to fight for the land of Israel, a war of self-defense, but Eliyotzim out b'kolet, and he could force the people to go with him. Avu mechemet reshut, an optional war, ein omotzi ombo, you cannot conscript the nation, ela alpi beitim shashim echad, you need a Sanhedrin of 71, they would be the ones to declare war. So the king had unlimited power. I shouldn't say that. The king seemingly had unlimited power, but he really didn't. Many of the powers of the king were restrained. Prophets routinely rebuked the kings, and consequently, occasionally, kings pursued the prophets also. In the ancient world, and much of the modern, there's no such thing as an independent judiciary. It doesn't mean, like leftists in Israel think, that the Supreme Court here should legislate laws and dictate policies and appointments and have dictatorial powers. No, it means that it is distinct from the ruling authority and can curb its powers within an agreed upon framework. But you need an agreed upon framework. In many countries, probably in the world today, as historically in most countries, the court takes its dictates from the rulers and is not at all independent. One famous example is Natan Sharansky, at the end of his famous speech before the court, which the Soviet court would sentence him to Siberia, and he made his famous declaration, L'shana ba Yerushalayim. He then added, now I turn to you, the court, who were required to confirm a predetermined sentence. To you, I have nothing to say. There is no independent judiciary in most of the world today. So this idea of the separation of powers was unknown even in ancient Greece, in ancient Rome, where the court served the needs of the emperor and justice was swift and summary. But we had not only a king and an independent court and independent prophets, we also had the kahuna, the priesthood, also distinct from the melech. And the melech, the king, was also bound by the law, like every other Jew. And so to drive home this idea, he had to write his own Sefer Torah. And he had to carry it with him at all times. Livilti rum livavo me'achav. Ulvilti sur mena matzoy yaminu small. Lest he become too haughty. Lest he deviate from the Torah to the right or to the left. In the Jewish state, again, unlike ancient times, the king is not the source of the law, and the king is not above the law. This was revolutionary, so much so that we too, in the form of less worthy kings, struggle with that. There are many leaders today of democracies, in the recent past, we know who they are, who still think if the president does it, it can't be illegal. The president has absolute powers and immunity from anything that he does because he's the president, because he's the prime minister, because he's the king. It's not so. But nonetheless, this idea eventually took root. Ideally, power is diffused among various organs of government. So this was a Jewish idea, although the world traces it, even after the Greeks and the Romans, to Montesquieu, and to Locke. Aristotle wrote of mixed government, but primarily in the legislative sphere and not beyond that. And thus there are Gentile scholars, like William Albright, for example, is quoted by Professor Shapiro, who perceive the world's first democracy not in ancient Greece, but in ancient Israel. And certainly a fundamental Torah notion is Acherav Mlahatot, that we follow the majority when a matter is disputed. As such, Amrinan Zil Bata Rubu. We have to follow the rove in legal matters, in determination of halacha by the appropriate authorities. As to their minor limitations, but that is the operative law. Each tribe in ancient times had a nasi, a prince. They were elected by the people. The Sanhedrin ruled based on majority. So undoubtedly, these filtered down and shaped the world. Not that it was ever easy for any ruler to defer to the majority. It is not. It never is. Famous anecdote, probably apocryphal, but, you know, too good not to be true. Abraham Lincoln was opposed on some issue by every member of his cabinet. He was outvoted, and he declared, "There are seven nays, one aye, the ayes have it." He was the aye, he prevailed. That's the mentality of the leader, whether king or emperor, president or prime minister. Despite the accusations, which are very flip and superficial, we never had what political scientists or critics or today's polemicists would call a theocracy, ruled by God. That was not the Jewish system. We had the divine Torah, but lo b'shamayim hi. The interpretation and application of that Torah was given over to human beings who decided based on their reason, based on their logic, based on precedent, based on the Mesorah, and then based on the majority view. Just to conclude, Rav Hirsch writes on the famous Pasuk in Vayera, before God informs Avram of this fate of Sodom, that God says, "I know ki dativ leman yitzavet bonav beit achar," he's going to command, direct his household, his children, "vishamru derech Hashem la'asod zdako mishpat," they will keep God's way, preserve it, to do righteousness and justice. Listen to Rav Hirsch's words and see how relevant they are today. He said, not only by external means, not by enforcement of rules and laws, not by world upheavals which send the red peril against the palaces and manners of the rich, but only from within, by an inner revolution of mind and feelings, by the production of a generation to a sense of duty, can such men of duty be gained. The generation must be born and brought up not to a belief in God, but to fulfilling His commands. Meaning, actions speak louder than belief, actions speak louder than words. And when we internalize what the purpose of a legal system is, a democratic system, a polity, what the purpose is, to better people's lives, give them awareness of the beauty that surrounds us in mankind, when it does, and not just the tawdriness or the violence, the barbarity, everything that drags us down, we see what the ideal is because we brought to the world that ideal. And Rav Hirsch writes something that we have to keep in mind, a generation that is degenerating morally has also no social future. One is dependent on the other. If you have no moral sense, if there's no morality, there's no future for any society, because ultimately it becomes just a man-eat-man world. So these are just some of the institutions that we brought to the world and thereby shaped the history of mankind down to this day, and especially when we are positive influences, as I hope in these regards we are. When it comes to marriage, Shabbat, the day of rest, even the norms of civil government. Next time, we'll discuss the great ideas that we bequeath to civilization. Once again, I thank you very much and enjoy the rest of your day.